So, encounters with Jesus, Zacchaeus does social justice. Let's begin with a bit of historical geography. This encounter with Jesus took place in Jericho City, which is described as the city of palm trees, a welcome oasis in the Jordan Valley before the difficult ascent to Jerusalem. Remember Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho? Well, Jericho is believed to be one of the oldest inhabited cities in the world, and the city with the oldest known protective wall, apparently dating back at least to 9000 BC. Jericho was also the last city for Jewish pilgrims traveling westwards from the Jordan Valley to Jerusalem, some 25 kilometers away. Up a steep incline called the Ascent of Adumim. This was probably a five-hour trek, described by a modern walker as being ear-popping, brow-sweating, and heart-pounding. It would therefore have been natural for any traveler to take a rest in Jericho before making the ascent, and also to make that ascent well before darkness, because of its reputation for banditry, as Jesus himself explored in the parable of the Good Samaritan. So, what can we say about the timing of this encounter? According to my analysis, this event took place a mere 3 to 4 weeks before Jesus's arrest, trial, execution, burial, and resurrection. My understanding is that Jesus was actually on his way to Bethany with his disciples, having been informed a few days earlier about his close friend Lazarus's grave illness and then his subsequent death. So, based on practical logistics, Jesus probably arrived in Jericho around mid-morning from the site of his ministry across the Jordan, perhaps some 10 or so kilometers from Jericho. He then ultimately ended up at Zacchaeus's house for lunch, after which he presented the well-known parable of the talents. By that time, it must have been at least mid-afternoon, and onward travel up the ascent of Adumim would not have been advisable, even in the presence of his large entourage of disciples. It is therefore very likely indeed that Jesus actually slept over at Zacchaeus's house that night and did not just take the polite cup of tea with him that I remember singing about at Sunday school. If this is right, then when Jesus set off on the following morning after breakfast, he was heading straight to Bethany prior to his raising of Lazarus from death later on that same day. So, what exactly happened here? Well, let's read it for ourselves from Luke chapter 18, beginning from verse 35. As Jesus approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening. They told him, "Jesus of Nazareth is passing by." He called out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Those who led the way rebuked him, told him to be quiet. But he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and ordered the man to be brought to him. When he came near, Jesus asked him, "What do you want me to do for you?" "Lord, I want to see," he replied. Jesus said to him, "Receive your sight. Your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus, praising God. When all the people saw it, they also praised God. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he could not because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost." You may wonder why it was that Jesus took such a huge risk with his reputation. As a starting point, it is important for us to recognize that Luke takes great delight in presenting cameos of Jesus investing time and energy in his interactions with the marginalized of his day. These ranged from the elderly to women and even to children, none of whom would typically have been given the time of day by anyone of importance. And even though we have seen Luke shock us by his inclusion of Jesus' parable in which the hero is a Samaritan, despised as being of mixed race and being an adherent of a contaminated faith, nothing has prepared us quite for the live scandal that is unfolding here. There is no doubt that Jesus' journey to Bethany this time around was being carried out with a very heavy heart indeed. And having had to choose to continue his ministry on the east side of the Jordan rather than drop everything and rush off to Bethany to heal his friend Lazarus. Nevertheless, the Gospels do not give us any sense of impatience on Jesus' part with those that he had to interact with during this journey. These challenges included having to address an unseemly squabble for power amongst his own dear apostles, and the healing of at least two wretched blind men in Jericho. First, on his way into Jericho, which we read about just now, at the Eastern Gate, and later at the Western Gate on his way out. Although it was to delay him even further, Jesus now felt it necessary to respond proactively to an unspoken invitation from a person who would have been regarded by his fellow citizens as the worst kind of collaborator with Rome, a callous leech and heartless exploiter, living off the misery of his own people, a true sinner in any language. I'm personally in no doubt whatsoever that Zacchaeus must surely have been a very strong contender for the title of person least deserving of Jesus' attention. And yet here we are, watching Jesus sharing a meal with the enemy, and even daring to sleep over. So the question that immediately comes to mind is, just whose side is Jesus on? It is now time to look at the encounter itself and the key issues that it raises. We'll probably never know what Jesus actually said to Zacchaeus over lunch that day, But whatever those words were that Jesus uttered, together with the mere fact of his decision to honor Zacchaeus by spending time with him, ended up being transformative in a way that we very rarely see in practice. But as with all such things, it came at a price. There is no doubt at all here that this scene presents us with yet another occasion on which Jesus has given us a practical display of truly sacrificial love. There is nothing here of the moralistic, "You've been disgustingly reprehensible and should be utterly ashamed of yourself," nor the more menacing, "Come the revolution, you'll be first up before the firing squad." The reality behind true societal transformation, in my view, is that someone has to take the first step in being vulnerable. If our weapons for transformation are based on either sheer force or guilt manipulation, then I am convinced that whatever social change we do manage to engineer will simply go underground and eventually fade away, but not before it has morphed into a different form of social injustice. The biblical teaching is clear in 1 John 4:19, which says, "We love because he first loved us," and definitely not because he either condemns or embarrasses us into submission. In this particular incident, we see Jesus' love expressed in his recognition of Zacchaeus, not as a member of a deservedly hated and despised subsection of society, but as an individual that Jesus deemed to be worthy of attention, even though this would delay his own personal plans and the resolution of his intense emotional pressure by yet another day. While it is easy to make the claim to be an activist for social justice, there is a deep cautionary lesson to be learned here in the crowd's behavior. On the one hand, they correctly condemned Zacchaeus's exploitative behavior and what he stood for. And yet at the very same time, they reveal their own social justice blind spot in their dismissive, arrogant, and hurtful attitude towards the blind beggar, who was even further down the food chain, as they rebuked him and told him to shut up. I doubt very much that they were polite in their comments. This reminds me of Jesus' haunting words, "Let he who's without sin cast the first stone." So, true social justice can never be about stone throwing at all, but always about sacrifice. And here I mean self-sacrifice, and not the sacrifice of others in our cause. And so here we see Jesus sacrificing his hard-earned personal reputation as a moral societal leader. This was the price I mentioned before that was necessary to give Jesus at least the possibility of being a catalyst for a potentially monumental transformation. This transformation would reach beyond the life of an unworthy individual and would become the ultimate cause of a massive socioeconomic transformation that affected all the poor in Jericho. In the end, although my talk is ostensibly about Zacchaeus, this is ultimately a story about Jesus, his sacrificial initiative on behalf of an undeserving reactionary, and the tangible impact of that intervention on both individuals and the poorest of the poor. It's time to dig a little bit deeper to explore Zacchaeus's precise response. The narrative is very specific. Zacchaeus' response was twofold, each component being essential. First, we see Zacchaeus' commitment to proactive restitution. Zacchaeus' recognition of his personal contribution to injustice is represented in his commitment to repay capital plus damages, based on the principles of Exodus 22, verse 1, which says, if a man steals an ox or sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. The lesson is clear. Pay back the money. But while doing so, also include damages for the suffering of those who were wronged. But second, I find myself mesmerized by Zacchaeus' decision to share his wealth, but this time with no sense of legal indebtedness. This proactive reaching out is completely different from his restitutionary intervention, and in my view holds the key for real societal socio-economic transformation. Even in today's world, our modern South Africa, and more globally, within the racially driven prejudice that has given birth to the Black Lives Matter movement and is applicable also in the context of other social justice issues and pain points. Such a proactive response comes out of the recognition that the entire world system in every age exists in and is infused with systematic societal inequity. I may work hard and ethically for my money, but that supposedly clean money was partially sourced from exploitative practices by others down the line. And even if it was not, its quantum reflects the arbitrary hierarchy of rewards that society permits me to extract legally from my activities. Before exploring this further, I found it absolutely fascinating to note the implication of the order in which Zacchaeus presented his response. By beginning with giving away half of his wealth to the poor, Zacchaeus ensured that his restitution commitment would be paid out of the half that he had left for himself. If he had deducted the cost of restitution first, then he would have been essentially imposing half of his restitution liability upon the poor, who would therefore in effect be subsidizing his restitution promise. Zacchaeus' intervention was structured to avoid this. Returning to Zacchaeus' sharing of his wealth, I see this half of my wealth intervention as a way of implementing the idea that when I eat, someone else should also eat. It is interesting to note that God also tried to embed the principle of the year of Jubilee in his model society of Israel, by means of which all land was to be returned to its original owners every 50 years. The aim was to create a way of regularly resetting the inevitable socio-economic imbalances that arise within any society over time. This was a brilliant idea, whose implementation, unfortunately, seems to have petered out very soon after it was instituted. In our day, if we put aside the use of force, then Zacchaeus's voluntary approach is all that is left to us in practice for us to emulate. The last theme I shall highlight is the issue of privilege. Privilege actually is an interesting word. It has 9 letters, but it's definitely become a 4-letter word in our day. Before proceeding with this section, please accept this disclaimer. I'm not a social scientist and must admit to being very much a Johnny come lately, or in South Africa speak, a mafikizolo, into the rather technical and very emotive world of gender and identity politics. My comments must therefore be understood to be the very personal opinions of a raw amateur in this field. So here goes. Privilege is a fact. All societies bestow privilege on one or other section of its society. They always have, and they always will. The only things that change are the precise nature of that privilege, the rules that each society uses to allocate that privilege, and the actual level of inequality that that society is willing to tolerate as a result of the unequal distribution of privilege. The reason why privilege is a constant reality emanates from its inextricable association with power, which is a reality in any organized society. And unfortunately, the exercise of power is generally expressed in a selfish use of the agency that it commands. In my view, privilege is potentially a good thing, rather than the bad thing it is sometimes made out to be. We give out of what we have, not out of what we do not have. So relative privilege is the source from which we give. The issue about privilege is not its existence, or even who has it, but how the agency that comes with it is used. In particular, the defining feature of privilege is whether it is hoarded or shared. The problem is that as flawed human beings, our brokenness tends to support hoarding, either due to greed for more or the fear of losing what we already have and thereby risk becoming destitute in an uncaring and cruel world. Sadly, it is precisely this attitude that makes the world uncaring and cruel in the first place. While our decision either to hoard or to share our privilege clearly affects personal issues of morality and therefore potentially of guilt, that decision of whether to hoard or to share is in fact a matter of survival. Jesus himself gave us a clear warning about this when he said that whoever clings to his life will lose it, but whoever gives it away will find it. At a practical level, because privilege almost by definition comes with agency, privilege must always make the first move. We see that very clearly in Philippians 2, which comments on Jesus' action as the most privileged being by far in the universe. When it says, "Who, being in very nature God, made himself nothing, taking the nature of a servant." Whether or not your views on privilege coincide with the assertions I've made above, I believe the comments expressed below definitely apply in practice. And I present them as a challenge that I would like to leave with all of us today. So how destructive is the hoarding of privilege? The best way I could find of communicating this, at least my view of this, is by means of the following tale of two seas. The first is the Sea of Galilee. This is a fresh, living lake that feeds and waters millions of people across the modern state of Israel and beyond. The second is the Dead Sea. This is a bitter, dead lake that feeds none and would kill any who would dare to drink deeply from it. The same life-giving Jordan flows into both of them. So what's the difference? Just one thing. One lake permits its waters to flow out beyond itself, and the other does everything it can to keep its inflow to itself. By giving itself away, the first both lives and enlivens, but by hoarding its inflow, the second one both kills and dies. Its legacy is a name that describes it perfectly. The Dead Sea. I would like to actually just end off with a prayer for a world in pain. Branded by the abuse of the powerful, singed by the pain of their victims, seared by their impotent rage and despair. Lord, give us grace to listen to their cries until we hear, to hear until we feel, to feel until we rage, to rage until we weep, and to weep until we are transformed into wounded healers to a world of pain. Thank you.